You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Great. Great to be with you, Glenn.
Glenn Lowry, The Glenn Show, bloggingheads.tv, coming from Brown University, the Watson Institute on International and Public Affairs. Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv, talking to Larry Kotlikoff, the economist extraordinaire. Want to talk about his paper, The Big Con, which is a very interesting paper, Larry. And we also want to talk a little bit about this Harvard affirmative action case. What else you want to talk about?
Well, anything else that pops out, you know, I'm not sure there's any great economic issues that are really that compelling compared to these issues right now. I mean, we've got the trade issue, but we've talked about that a bit.
Just for a moment, do you think that there's any benefit in the Trumpian kind of aggressive strategy on the trade negotiation? Do you think the NAFTA deal, the new NAFTA 2, is better than the NAFTA 1 and so forth?
The problem is that Trump seems to know so little economics and is so focused on PR that that there's, unless you're really an insider, the details of what was changed, they just don't seem that big. They don't seem that important. So it all seems like he started a fight and then had to surrender and then claim victory. So that's what I'm getting from people that seem to know some details about the NAFTA agreement or the new NAFTA. So that's...
Okay, so how would we know? What would be the factual indicators that in a year or 18 months would give some... Is it the composition of trade? Are you following investment flows? What would some stock price fluctuations say something about the success of trade? How would you measure it?
Well, I think... you know, if we have free competition between the two countries, free trade, improved, you know, if the trade was unfree, for example, if the Mexicans had super high tariffs or the Canadians had super high tariffs compared to us and they came down, that would be an indicator. But that's not been the case. The U.S. has very high tariffs on certain products. So I mean, every country has some pretty high tariffs on particular products, but our tariffs are not particularly low compared to everybody else that we're trading with internationally. So I don't get the problem to begin with. I think this is the manufactured problem. The issue of intellectual property rights with China, that may be a real issue that individual companies don't want to take on. So I think the way to deal with that is to do with the Chinese what the U.S. does to there's much more directed ways to deal with that problem.
Okay, no, I get that. I want to ask, though, about strategy and trade. So we're economists, and I heard you gesture at a theory about open trade and such as being efficient. And that is what we say. That is what we believe. Is there anything to the idea that there's a strategic how should I put it? Is there any legitimate interest in whether or not China displaces the United States as a hegemonic global power? Does that have anything to do with economics, with trade, with who owns what? You're going to allow Chinese capital to own what, including intellectual property about the United States? Are there any implications of nationalism? Here's another way of putting my question. We have a theory of free trade based on how markets are going to work, allocating resources. What about the political forces? And so this the notion about nationalism, economic, as economists, do we just dismiss that with the back of our hand? There's no kind of, or what would be, I'm sorry, Larry, I hope you see my question. What would be a legitimate role for nationalism in the context of a country's global trade strategy?
Well, there might be some argument about conglomeration economies, you know, something about if we can raise everybody together collectively in society, get them to learn, for example, how to produce products, they can complement each other. And so there's going to be these positive externalities that only the government can make sure and ensure are going to be, achieved. And to do that, you need to protect certain industries, get people to learn certain skills so that over time there's this core sufficient level of skilled labor that can then help educate the next generation. So there are some arguments like this. The U.S. is a big, big economy. It has, it's not kind of a, I'm not sure that you can claim that it's got infinite industries that need to be protected to get them going, to jumpstart them. China, on the other hand, has been engaging in that activity for a while, trying to protect industries and, why is it trying to get this technology into China? It feels like it's a backward, some level of backward place in terms of technology. And it's made a concerted effort to get the top technology into China so we can get the Chinese, workers, up to par with top workers around the world. And I think they've been successful in achieving that. So, that's actually a positive. And then they've been able to help us by selling us products, excellent products at very low prices. So we have had a stake in helping them with their development strategy. It's not so clear that this development strategy, they're importing technology from us, I'm not saying they should have been allowed to steal it or should be continuing to be allowed to steal it, but assisting them in obtaining technology is not necessarily, if we're not talking about military technology, it's not clear that it's damaging to us if they can sell us parts to cars, for example, in the future that are much cheaper.
I want to offer, I don't know, I think it's a counter narrative. I want to suggest something. So what about the evolutionary? So look at it from an evolutionary point of view. What strategies are going to be robust against invasion by other strategies? So one strategy is completely rejecting any kind of mercantilism, any kind of nationalist economic policy, worrying about our companies, what share of the whatever, and kind of letting the chips fall where they may, and you know, going with the most efficient flows. That's a kind of naive strategy, okay? But believing that all the international actors who have market power, because they're big, whether they're big in currency markets or they're big in the dynamic game of investment in new technology, solar panels or whatever manufacturing technique or whatever, or big in some sense, they're big, they're actors, they have monopoly power, they can influence stuff. So they can direct their policy in a strategic way. So now that's one kind of pattern of government behavior. Another kind is a laissez-faire kind of neoclassical kind of vision, which is a kind of, you know, we're going to trust that everything's going to work out okay. Don't you think if in a world in which everybody is playing the naive strategy, that there's going to be gains to somebody who's strategic, who has, I mean, you yourself spoke of the Chinese development plan. I mean, that. So do you see what I'm getting at? I mean, I'm trying to say, shouldn't there be some America-oriented strategy?
Yeah,
about how to engage, and that's what isn't that what is implied by what Trump has been, the rhetoric that he has been here.
No, I think he's trying to do a strategy on the cheap. But the strategy that's going to work is not to monopolize trade or monopsonize it, but rather to educate the public. You know, think about an alternative strategy. Think about the fact that China is investing like crazy in universities and second in education in general, and the U.S. is not. And suppose Trump announced a policy of providing uniform online education to kids in primary and secondary school around the country so that everybody spent 4 hours a day from age, let's say, from the third grade up through the 12th grade, spend 3 or 4 hours a day getting the same education online with a headset on. So it's like one to one, it's a teacher student ratio one to one because you've got one screen, one teacher on that screen teaching you when you've got a headphone, so you're not being distracted by other kids. that to me could revolutionize and equalize education in the U.S. because that's our big problem over time with China. It's not whether they're selling us a little more steel or less. We're buying our soybeans too cheaply. That's the issue here, that we're not educating our, we're not taking care of the next generation.
Okay. So Larry, we changed the subject and that's okay. Cause I like this question that you're talking about now. And I want to know what from, you've written big books about how to reform healthcare, how to reform the tax system, the social insurance programs, education as a, I mean, you're certainly right to say that we're not keeping up. And I think it shows in many, many ways. It shows in the composition of our graduate programs. I don't know about yours at Boston University, but I can tell you about mine at Brown, where you see who the people are who are coming in, who are really sharp people at the frontier of your discipline, okay? And they are very often not from the United States of America.
Yes.
You can speaking of the Harvard affirmative action case, you can have affirmative action for American graduate students and probably have a defensible case.
I think that's probably going on. We have probably five American kids out of a class of 30.
So my question to you is, as somebody who thinks big about these social policy areas, because there are all these controversies about education, about charter schools, Betsy DeVos, all that kind of stuff, all this stuff about teachers' unions and about reform and whatnot. And, you know, American education is so variegated and the resource distribution and all of that. But what would you sort of think as a big think policy about how to revivify development, the intellectual cognitive development of the American population?
I think a massive effort to provide super high speed internet throughout the country, in every school around the country, give every kid tablets, phones, laptops, and just flood society with educational tools and make it part of the curriculum and the required curriculum, and have parents assign parents homework with their kids to watch these videos at night, and make, because we're all stuck looking at these screens anyway, but most of us are looking at junk on these screens.
Yeah.
Well, listen, why not look at something useful? But that, all that material has to be produced as a public good, and, you know, to have society be more educated. We can lower violence. We're going to lower crime rates. Every prison cell in the country should have a screen teaching courses all day long to people. There's a path forward that's
easier said than done, Larry. Easier said than done. You have to integrate this into the ongoing systems of service delivery. And that's a heavy lift, man.
The thing about this is that I think it's relatively cheap because getting courses are already being taught. All you have to do is videotape them, find the best teachers. We already have the internet. You don't have to tell unions. Okay. I wouldn't go to a school and say you have to use this curriculum.
Okay.
I would say it's free. Use it and have the teacher walk around and give individualized attention to each student.
I have your answer to my question. Got it. I want to move on. Do you mind?
Sure. No problem.
So you want to talk about this Harvard thing? You were. I want the audience to know that I'm just back from Toulouse. That I was there for 6 weeks. And as part of kind of paying my keep while I was in residence at the university, I offered a kind of mini course on Fridays for a month. There were five meetings of it on affirmative action, largely focused on U.S. Themes, but trying to frame the big questions about affirmative action policy as some kind of rigorous analytical framework, as an economist would do. I hope I lived up to your high expectations, Larry.
Yeah, your slides are fantastic. So
I shared my slides on this course with Larry, and we were going to talk about the Harvard case because he's there in Boston.
You put them on your website so they're public. Or somehow get them available.
Well, I could put them up, sure. I could put them up. Oh, I see. That'll be a part of this educational thing that you're talking about.
Absolutely, yeah.
Set the scene, just a lawsuit brought by a legal activist guy on the right who also brought this case from Texas previously that got to the Supreme Court. the Asian students, Asian American students suing alleging discrimination in admissions practice by Harvard. Expert witnesses on either side. I don't know if you had a chance to look at any of those materials, Larry. And I did excerpt in my slides some of the data tables and charts from Peter Arcia Decano, who was testifying on behalf of the plaintiffs, and from David Card. These are two leading labor economists, Arcia Decano at Duke and Card at UC Berkeley. You know, you had a chance to look at some of that data. I don't know. What's your general reading on this case, and how do you think it should go and the implications of it and whatnot?
Well, first of all, the Supreme Court has said that you can use race as a legal means of selecting a class to improve diversity in your class. I think there's a for the students themselves, for the educational process, having a diverse class provides more, you know, more opinions, more point angles. I think it's part of an educational experience to be surrounded by people that are in large part different from you, because you're learning not just the material in class, but you're learning from them about their experiences, and they have different perspectives. So that's, important. So now if you take something like, race as a criteria, if we're thinking about, you know, blacks versus whites versus Asians, these are racial categories. If the Supreme Court has said that race is an acceptable and, indeed they're blessed, using race to make court classes, produce a diversity, then you have to have some mechanism that upgrades, let's say, blacks in this context in the scoring for deciding who to get it, who to admit, and downgrades other people. Now, whether you do what, let's say that the plaintiffs in this case against Harvard are correct, and that what Harvard did was in order to
wait a minute, just repeat that. I lost you for a minute. Let's presume you say.
Let's just suppose that the plaintiffs in the Harvard case are correct.
Yes,
and that that Harvard systematically downgraded the personality scores of Asians in order to produce a more balanced class. Well, they could have not done that, but they could have upgraded everybody else's personality. Or some other criteria, they could have just added extra points to whites or and blacks for some other, and you would have had the same outcome.
Yeah.
Okay. So it cannot be the case that it's legal to upgrade certain groups, but it's illegal to downgrade certain groups when the outcome is exactly the same. That's just a difference in language. A law cannot be legal if it's written in one set of words and illegal if it's written with another set of words. So
okay,
I think
let me interrupt for a minute, Larry, because I think your point is subtle and important, which is that it's already been authorized what they say is strict scrutiny for racial classification, a narrowly tailored program in pursuit of a compelling public interest. That's been upheld. So that is a pro-black, let's say, minority policy, which when integrated into a system of social interaction will in the equilibrium imply a negative effect relative to some baseline for the other group, and in this case, Asians. So the fact that it might be found that Harvard's evaluations of students was in a way tilted to the disadvantage of Asians on behalf of the project of including more blacks, if that were to be found, it still wouldn't be any worse. It wouldn't be any worse of a violation of any principle than would a program undertaken on behalf of blacks. And therefore, if that's okay, this other thing has to be okay as well.
Simple argument. Yeah, it has to be. You cannot. And in the affirmative action in the Affordable Care Act decision that Justice Roberts decided, he made it clear that assessing a penalty on not getting health insurance was like taxing,
being
uninsured. And that we can't, he in effect used this argument that the law has to be, neutral to language. If the law is written in French, it's got to, have the same impact as if it's translated into English, it's going to have
a nice point, Larry. It's a kind of no money illusion. I mean, that's kind of, you know, we economists, no money illusion,
right?
Issue, you know, things in terms of their real valuation. So, okay. But I want to talk about affirmative action because I want, you say, diversity is a good thing. And I agree. Are the test scores a good thing? Is there anything real in the data that show the vast racial disparity between Asians and Blacks? It's vast. This is in the Harvard data. We could look it up. In terms of, let's say, suppose you were to rank the students who applied to Harvard by the decile of their overall academic evaluation. This is a kind of weighted average of their test scores and grades, AP courses and whatnot. They come up with an index. So you have the population, 10% of them are in each of these 10 deciles. What percentage of Blacks are in the top decile? What percentage of Asian applicants are in the top decile? What percentage of Blacks are in the bottom decile of applicants in terms of the social, and what percentage of Asians are in the bottom decile? So 10% would be parity in each of the deciles. So if you look at the percentage of Blacks who are in the top decile, the top two deciles, it's like 10. I mean, it's like 6-8% in the top two deciles. You look at the share of Asians who are in the top two deciles, it's like 30%, 40% in the top two deciles. Likewise, if you look at the bottom deciles, the vast proportion of African-American applicants are in the bottom two or three deciles relative to a scant number of Asians. Now, I don't want to belabor the point. Diversity matters. I'm asking you now whether or not these differences in academic preparation or performance prior to admission matter.
Well, they do matter. I mean, if they didn't matter, we would just have probably just a random selection process.
And that would be a disaster, wouldn't it?
Well, it would be a disaster for maybe Harvard University.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
But that may not be a disaster. Might not be a disaster for the entire country.
Well, can I just, I'm sorry to interrupt.
100 years
ago.
This
is a really important point. We're already dealing with elitism. Affirmative action doesn't really become an interesting binding constraint until we start dealing with elitism. So it is in some way parasitic on an anti-egalitarian structure. Yeah, I mean, you just said it in so many words. You said if you wanted to be Harvard, you had to be selective. If you were going to be selective, et cetera, then it would matter what these differences were. Otherwise, you just admit people at random, in which case you wouldn't need affirmative action because it would just come out statistically. So there's a kind of dependency on the scarcity of elite positions, which is what drives the whole, that's what makes it a really important question, how this kind of case gets decided.
Right. And we know that we don't have a perfect indicator in these academic measures of SAT scores or GPAs about somebody's ability to make money in the future. If we think about somebody's productivity, these things don't necessarily line up that closely with your future earnings. A lot of what lines up is your ability to be Glenn Lowry and sit hard and work hard until you're 200 years old, which is what we hope is going to happen here. You know, it's your.
I rather like the sound of that.
the German expression is Sitzfleisch, which is basically how much meat you have on your tush, how much time you can spend in the chair and actually work. And I don't think that that's, you know, when I went to grad school I went to Harvard, and how I got in was, I think, totally accidental. I certainly was not the smartest, from any but perspective, the smartest kid. But the two kids that we thought were the smartest, everybody said were the smartest, they never made it through the program because they didn't have the patience to do their work.
Yeah.
And we're just off. They got diverted.
Okay. Yeah, I got it. Let me ask, I want to go back to the thing we were talking about a minute ago, which was what matters coming in. And you say diversity matters, and I'm saying that the differences in academic preparation also matter. And you're saying you can't tell who's going to be successful in life. The wages might be high because they're more productive in other ways. And what I want to say is, as a teacher, I really like teaching talented students.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, somebody who's quick and who gets it and who asks interesting questions. All right. Somebody who actually follows the details and is not talking in generalities and is creative. Now, we're in a technical discipline. We're in a science. And these things have a logic. They require intellectually demanding engagement, training, and talent. Now, those are real things. This is what I'm saying at the end of the day. If you're rationing, I mean, think about it this way. Undergraduate admissions is one thing. A PhD program is another. I'm not going to admit people into a PhD program with standard or two standard deviation differences in their test scores. Okay? You and I both know that we're not going to do that. Now, if there are not enough blacks with high test scores, there's just not going to be enough blacks in this program based on that logic, because we're not going to so reconfigure the intellectual enterprise that we're engaged in as to accommodate that kind of variation in the technical mastery manifested by the students who are in our care. Now, there can be all kinds of rhetoric, you know, we should overcome remediation, we should whatever, whatever.
Okay, but
you know, when you're up there at the blackboard writing out the model and somebody actually gets it, and they say, they interrupt and they say, Professor Lowry, didn't you mean beta prime instead of beta? Do you understand what I'm talking about? That's, I mean, this is what you want. This is the real deal. The real deal. Okay, so here's my question, Larry, about affirmative action. What do you think the condition is of a population whose presence in the rarefied halls of intellectual activity is mainly premised upon the extent to which they affect a diversity of that environment in terms of ethnicity relative to people whose presence in the environment is based upon the mastery that I just got through alluding to, okay? Where that's common knowledge. That's common knowledge amongst everybody who's participating. I mean, there are deep psychological novels that could be written about the situation that I'm describing here. What do you think equality consists of? Who is a client and who's a patron in such a situation? What dishonesties, I'm serious about this, will insinuate themselves into our thinking as a way of accommodating the consequences of the real disparities in human development in this environment that we're engaged in. Now, can we be honest with each other? We're patronizing people at the highest levels of a selective intellectual performance in the great universities of this country, in the great programs of science and engineering and social science and humanity studies. We are patronizing the disadvantaged group. I'm talking about blacks. To the extent that we decide to look the other way when there are manifest differences in their preparation. And this is the elephant in the room, the ugly elephant in the room that dare not speak its name. Because as soon as you speak of it, someone is going to say that you're trafficking in some kind of eugenics or some kind of genetic. And I'm not. I'm talking about the acquired capacities to perform particular kinds of intellectual work.
Okay, but I hear you, Glenn, but I'm thinking about the acquired capacities of the next generation whose father or mother got a PhD from a top school. And maybe they weren't the top in the class, and maybe they got a lot of help getting through because they had terrible poor preparation, or maybe it's just their talent. They weren't that talented, but they were helped, and that made a difference to their first job and to their success, and that fed through over time. I mean, you've written about this intergenerational transmission of inequality. You're the star in this area. This is where you're going to get your Nobel Prize from, some of this work that you did. So I'm just going to bring you back to your earlier work that what we do now is going to have an impact through time and permeate. So this is not a all or nothing. This is a very nuanced balancing act. And I think that's what the Supreme Court said. You can use race to a certain extent to balance the class, and you can go, yes, you can go overboard, take people that are not well prepared, who are going to miss the beta prime. But over time, by interacting with other students who are going to get the beta prime, if they can, you know, stick in the course and get through, then that will percolate through time to their children, and that will matter for the next generation. So we have to think of this as a...
Okay, so I got two questions. I hear you. Think of it in a dynamic context, intergenerational and so forth. We're not locked into the patronizing situation. We hope to evolve into a more equal situation as the benefits from what we do percolate in terms of making more prepared and more competitive the next generation. So I have two questions. How long and why race? How long? Why race? So we're a half century. I mean, the speech that you just gave, which was a good one. I mean, I'm moved by it. No kidding. Was given first in 1966. And we're a half century on. So how long? But the other question is also really important. It's important in the age of Trump. Why race? Because the claims on behalf of mitigating the deleterious consequences of previous generations' deprivation is a claim that white people can make too. The logic here in the affirmative action debate about wanting to be colorblind is, I mean, you can trivialize it and say, oh, they mean we're just supposed to pretend like races don't exist, which of course no one with any good sense should say. But you can also make it into a more rigorous idea, I think, by saying that the point is not to shackle any particular administrative practice, like who gets admitted to a university. The point is to formulate the national goals and the policy objectives in a way that doesn't essentialize race, that doesn't make race into a value in and for itself. That would mean that if I had a concern about the lagging effects of previous generations' disadvantage, however that disadvantage came about, I would want to express that concern through programs that were not necessarily racially defined. And I do want to come back to this issue about honor, the group's reputation, respect, the kind of psychosocial dynamics of intra-organizational behavior in which you actually do have a sharp division of labor and you do have a stratified hierarchical order in terms of how the collective team's product is being generated, whether it be a university or a manufacturing facility or whatever. And the objective differences in people's cognitive functioning, not capacity, not intrinsic ability, they're functioning. Because these are educational institutions that we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you've touched on a lot of issues there. I think we could try and just say, well, look, anybody who's disadvantaged, we're going to give extra help to, and that, you know, if you're disadvantaged, a poor white person versus being a poor black person, it's the same disadvantage. I don't think that's the case. I think there's real racism in this country. I think there's, you say how long, why is it that in Hungary today we have anti-Semitism at the highest levels being, we have attacks on Soros by the Hungarian prime minister because he's Jewish, not because of any other, this is subtle or overt anti-Semitism. Hungarians have a good history of anti-Semitism, of killing Jews during the Nazi period. They were the right arm of the Nazis to a large extent at that time. So now we have And imagine that policy versus the policy where the Hungarians were taking every child to the main synagogue in Budapest and showing them where the Hungarians, not the Nazis, massacred hundreds of Jews in the synagogue during World War II. That would be a whole different future of Hungary. So, but what I'm trying to get across here is that there is persistence of racism that seems to be tribal, that's going to go on for centuries. We have to be fighting against it on an ongoing basis. So how long? I say forever. We need to be fighting racism forever, because every indication is that the racism persists. And
Well, I don't want to allow you just by the back of your hand to assimilate affirmative action policies to fighting racism. I think those are distinct. Those are distinct things. And we were talking about how long affirmative action in the context of educational institutions based upon providing opportunity for future generations. And I was trying to address the honor and dignity question. What I think of as the honor and dignity question, which I think gets elided, people just want to slide right past it, which is that there really are implications, deep implications. I think there's an impossibility theorem here, Larry. You can't have equality if you have a permanent structure where you have the racial preferences. There's no, something's going to have to give. Either, let me finish my thought. Something's going to have to give. Either the foundation of meritocratic discrimination that is functional, having no relationship to race. This is just about how you differentiate human activities within an organization based upon the variation in that population's capacities to do certain kinds of intellectual work. Not everybody's a professor. Not everybody's article gets published in a journal. Not everybody gets a Nobel Prize. These judgments are based upon, as I say, variation in human performance. You're way out in the right tail when you start talking about this stuff. Okay. So either you're going to give on that. You're going to compromise on that.
Yeah.
Or you're going to embed into the steady state of the dynamical system a race-dependent preference, which tacitly communicates the differences in the functioning of people at a particular kind of intellectual work. And my theorem of impossibility is you can't do that forever and have there be equality in any meaningful sense. Okay? There will be virtual
or quality. I think we need
superficial equality, but down underneath there's going to be a problem. Yeah?
Well, I think, you know, you're right. We can go overboard. We could destroy top universities like Harvard by just randomly choosing people to, you know, we could have no selection process, just randomly. Absolutely, we could go overboard and go the wrong way. But to the idea that we can't be, we don't need to perpetually be combating something that we know for a fact to be perpetual. Racism is perpetual. It goes on and on generation after generation in different ways. It's better sometimes. We have, and it may be directed towards this group at this period of time, and so we have to evolve our policies through time. And it may be that right now we need to engage in affirmative action of the kind that Harvard's been engaging in. And in the future, that won't be so important. But we can't just say this doesn't exist. You know, you look at the schools in a mile from where I live in Roxbury in Boston, and the quality of those schools, what's going on in those classes, and you look at the quality of the schools and what's going on in the educational experience for young kids, for 5-6-year-olds, 8-year-olds, it's totally different. So to say that these kids are not being discriminated against actively by, in terms of the quality of the education they're receiving, it's not true. So I do think.
Let me respond.
Yeah.
Because I don't agree with you at all.
Good.
I agree that there's a difference in the quality of education. Yes, I agree with that 100%. I think I'd be very interested in knowing what you want to do about that. But hold on, before you tell me, I want to relate this to affirmative action because that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about anti-racism. It is not to be at all conceded that the net effect of affirmative action is to somehow mitigate racism. If you're kumbaya, let's try to help the blacks. We understand the history has been rough. We're going to be in an anti-racist crusade. You evoke the Hungarian and the Jews and such. In a way, it proves my point. Because if the Jews were dependent upon the largesse of somebody to take care of them, they'd be up the creek, the proverbial creek, without a paddle. Okay? You have not so depended. Rather, you have seized such mastery as was available to you to seize in order to exert power and influence over the fate of your people. Now, for African Americans to be in the position that we hang by the thread of a Supreme Court decision about whether or not we can take place at Harvard when it's being overrun by Asians, to try to nest that within some generic concern about racism, Larry, I don't think is serious. Okay? I want to know how it is that blacks are going to be equal at Harvard if it's common knowledge that they cluster in the bottom few deciles of the people who apply in terms of their academic qualification, but they're represented in population proportionate numbers amongst the people who are actually admitted. You can't tell me that does not manifest itself in terms of a difference in performance after admissions, because I'm a college professor. I know it. I know it from my own personal experience in the classroom.
I know,
can we be serious about equality? I really want to answer to my question, because I've got an impossibility theorem that I'm conjecturing. I want to know how you're going to get to be equal. If you don't address the performance questions, let me just put it very plainly. If African-Americans don't raise our game, now, if you were talking to me about how we can raise their game, that would be different. But that would not be affirmative action at Harvard.
Well, I started talking to you about raising everybody's game by having uniform, or equalizing everybody's game by having uniform online education.
It wouldn't equalize everybody's game. You don't think that the home environment matters? You don't think the reason that the schools that are a short stone's throw from you in Roxbury and Boston differ from the schools that are in Lexington where you used to live, or that are in whatever, that they differ simply because, you know good and well, who goes to the PTA meeting matters?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things I referred to was giving the parents homework. And I'm not saying that we would achieve equality. I'm saying we would
move
in the direction of equality, equalizing, active verb here. If you end up with the Supreme Court is telling us in its prior rulings that if you end up, Glenn, with having five kids in your class who were, let's say, underperformed relative to the other kids on their GREs in your graduate course, in the graduate record exam, and got in because they were given preferential treatment because society felt they'd been underserved, discriminated against in their schooling, in their preparation, you're going to have to take a hit on that in terms of having to spend extra time with them to bring them up to speed. And that what the Supreme Court is saying is that that's our job, you and my job, to do our part to try and rectify these social differences.
Okay. I've got a different scenario. It reminds me of what Charles Murray said back in the 80s about welfare. We just wanted to go cold turkey and cut it out. If you cold turkey out of affirmative action and the numbers of African American because it's all qualitative and it's not going to be 0-1. But it would be a significant diminution of the extent to which you were exercising a racial preference relative to other things. Now, they say they can't have it both ways. They can't say, I'm talking in circles. I should be pointed.
I mean, I get your
point. I go cold turkey out of affirmative action. That's what I want to do. I want to create a scenario where...
Do you want to do this for sure, or do you want to do this for theoretical in terms of just discussing it? Is that really what you want to do?
Okay, I want to entertain a thought experiment is what I want to do. I'm not sure that is what I would want to do in the real world, but it's a outrageous, you know, it's a modest proposal in the Jonathan Swift
terms. You don't want to do it for sure because it contradicts too much of the things you think and write.
Well, I didn't say don't be concerned. What I'm talking about is a certain kind of tournaments or contests. And if you don't want them to be tournaments or contests anymore, don't let them be. But as long as within racial groups, you're sorting people along a certain dimension, and this is definitely the case, within racial groups, the kids that get admitted, on the whole, are the kids that have the better academic indices.
Right.
Okay. So as long as you are valorizing implicitly this particular human characteristic or trait as it's reflected and measured in the academic performance of the applicants prior to admission.
Right.
As long as you're valorizing that.
The kids are going to show up and they're going to be, and if you give them a break because they're black in admissions, they're going to, yes, they're going to live under a cloud.
So now you've got remediation. I mean, you know, look at it. I mean, I'm just trying to think of it in organizational terms. You've got remediation. Now there's no shame in remediation. You could have an efficiency argument about where the investment should take place in terms of the developmental life cycle and whether or not remediating is something in the efficient outcome that you want to do. But as a response to a given condition, it would be a necessity, I suppose, in one way, formally or informally, to do the remediation. This is another reason why I worry about race. I worry about the concentration of race amongst those who are engaging in the remediation and the social meaning of that. Whereas if it were a class stratified a variation in the entry level intellectual achievement that's required, if it were class stratified and you had remediation, you wouldn't be labeling the remediators racially. I actually am putting a lot of stock in this kind of profiling point, this kind of point that people will make tacit associations based upon average rates of performance as racialized. And you've racialized it already by having such a big public show about how magnanimous you are in trying to redress the consequences of history. So I my modest proposal is that we really think differently about equality. Because that, first of all, we make equality the goal. Equality of dignity and respect is the goal. Secondly, we are prepared to look reality in the eye. We're not going to lie to ourselves and say that what we know is not equal is equal. Okay. So you can't fake this honor. You can't, you know, we give these prizes. We give these prizes of, you know, I was just here where Daron Acemoglu, the economist at MIT, was awarded the Jean-Jacques Lafont Prize in honor of the late French economist. I was in Toulouse. He was a Toulouse man, Lafont. He and Thoreau built that school of economics there, which is a very excellent, as you know, center of economic research in continental Europe. And we give these prizes. So I'm back to this thing about stratification, about elitism, and about equality. And so there, see, in these contests of this kind, the contests that have this deep connection to variation in human performance along a rarefied kind of expression of mastery, craft, you know, depth of understanding, that we don't do race in that environment, that we don't use that as the place, as the site. There's many other sites that we could be focused on in terms of trying to remediate and rectify, not those sites. Because when you do that, you really foreclose from the black participants the capacity for achieving a certain kind of honor and affirmation of excellence. And how do you know? How do you know? Let me just finish this: that they're not feedback effects, such that when the sharpness of the signal communicated by African American participation is honed to a higher degree of sharpness in virtue of applying similar criteria of evaluation and selection, that the incentive rewards associated with that of dignity and honor and respect by their fellow peers wouldn't motivate people to higher levels of achievement. Don't patronize my people, Larry.
Well, I'll tell you what, Glenn, you know, you said, let me just respond. You know, we'll talk about my people, okay? I think, you know, you said that the Jews have somehow pulled themselves up from their bootstraps and,
I didn't quite say that, but okay. I said, okay. And,
survived through, centuries. I think they could have used some patronage in world, you know, when the Nazis came on board. I think they could use some patronage today when we have rising anti-Semitism. They're too small a group. The fact that there's only half of us here that would otherwise be probably, we could have used some patronage.
Let me ask you a question. Yes. Do you think it's anti-Semitic if a European, in Hungary or France held it against European Jews that Israel behaved vis-a-vis the Palestinians in a particular way? Is that anti-Semitism? I don't mean to presuppose an answer to the question. I literally, genuinely like to know what you think.
Well, if they held it against, you know, it's probably yes, probably that, because people, unless you know for sure what somebody's views are, you can't connect their views with the state of Israel's.
Sure, of course. And so I see that. But let me ask you another kind of question. Just let me ask this, because I want to put all these, you would make an interesting point. You say, don't let's play with words. The law has to mean the same thing no matter what language it's written in. And I'm trying to ask about fundamentals. And one of them was about anti-Semitism and the extent to which it was about really about collective responsibility and collective guilt. Right. And imputing to someone who happened to be Jewish walking on the street in Paris the burden of some kind of moral responsibility for the behavior of, quote, the Jews, close quote, as manifested in the policies of the state of Israel. But so I want to ask another kind of question. And that is, peoplehood, we are a people, okay? So suppose a people, a group of human beings, based upon some characteristic of shared ancestry or culture, asserted peoplehood. Then, now that's a consciousness kind of thing. That's a sense of identity. That's a sense of, in some sense, collective project of purpose. If we're talking millions or tens of millions of people, of course, individuals' relationship to this ideal construct of peoplehood will vary. And some will be more closely tied to it in some sense, and for some it will be a less significant part of their lives. But peoplehood, okay, understood as a kind of collective consciousness. So now consider the position of someone who sits outside of the people. A non-member, observing people. To what extent is that person entitled in their own assessments and inferences and evaluations to take on board the affirmation of peoplehood of the collectivity that they're observing in terms of, well, what? Common purpose. I hope I don't sound like I'm trying to justify anti-Semitism, because I'm not. I'm asking about what are the limits of self-affirmation that wouldn't at some level logically and almost necessarily trigger some kind of collective imputation. A responsibility, maybe that goes a state too far, but you know, collective punishment is not something that would be unknown to the Israeli consciousness, for example. I mean, the idea that you would inflict pain on people based upon their, I don't attribute this to you, but based upon their knowledge that there's a subjective connection to them. So if I punish this one, the incentive properties of such a system of punishment might be very, very efficient. But do you see the question? The question is the relationship of insider assertion of peoplehood to outsider imputation of peoplehood.
Well, give it to me a little bit more clearly. So, I mean, when you say insider attribution of peoplehood, it could be that I don't attribute or connect myself much to Jewish people.
Sure.
And other people attribute me to being Jewish. So I guess it's the pretty big issue that should I be accused of something that others in my group did? Probably not. No, that doesn't seem, if I'm not at all responsible for that, I don't see how I can be rightfully accused of that. Is that the question?
No, I concede that point. I, as I said, I think people will vary in their relationship to the mythic ideal about peoplehood, and you know, the stereotype treatment of somebody based upon the fact that they belong to a group, when there's variation within the group, and you can't necessarily assume that the average is true of everybody in it. I concede all of that. I was really talking about a we, they. Okay, so if a group of people say we, then another group of people are going to say they. And that there's often in the saying of they, a presumption about some kind of ism, some kind of anti-Semitism or some kind of racism or something like that in the saying of the they. Right. And the point I'm trying to make is that the saying of the we almost is going to call forth an echo of the they, at least in some circumstances. And the more coherently and assertively is the we said, the more probably base is going to be the imputation of the they.
To bring it back to the whole discussion of the Harvey case, you're kind of claiming, saying, look, the more we make race a visible part of, or a major part of, or a prominent aspect of admission, the more we're going to put a stigma on blacks. We're going to have more reaction by true racists that blacks are getting preferential treatment, and there could actually be more racism, a counter reaction to that.
That's not what I'm saying.
That's not what you're saying. I'm missing.
It's not the counter reaction that I'm concerned about. Everything is not racism. I was concerned about the equality and the dignity of the people who were in the subordinate position, and about the steady state, the long-term equilibrium condition where it has become institutionalized that they rely in common knowledge, where everyone is aware that this is the case, upon less rigorous assessments of their academic and intellectual performance.
Yeah, I get that.
In a rarefied environment. Now, if it's a social club, if it's just a training camp to go on to the American elite, where nobody is actually taking all that seriously, the hurly-burly competition of getting to the top in the front of the class, if it's that, then maybe it doesn't matter so much. That's why I say that there are two things that are in conflict. One is our egalitarian aspiration to try to equalize across racial groups. And the other is the structurally relevant differentiation of task. You can model this, Larry, in terms of how you're producing the human capital that's coming out at the end of the thing. And it relies upon complementarity. Can't you see the model? People are varying in terms of their mastery over certain kind of intellectual work. Some tasks are very elastic with respect to that characteristic. Others are not so. The organization is producing output collectively from the partition of outputs that are coming from these different kinds of tasks, and you're allocating people across these tasks. And what I'm saying is that either you flatten that gradient so that task differentiation is not as sensitive to intellectual performance difference, which allows you to accommodate a more heterogeneous intake of people whom you brought into the organization. Or you acclimate yourself to different representation in the organization by the racial groups, accepting the objective fact of their different performance in terms of these various measures of intellectual work. And that way does not lie equality. That, I'm still back to my theorem.
Okay, you're back to...
But that's what I'm saying, not that it's going to evoke more racism. Do you understand?
I got you. Okay. All right. Well, I missed on that. But you are back to patronism and whether this is a major problem, a major concern, and something strong enough, a big enough problem for us to really put an end to any racial consideration in admissions. That's kind of where you're coming from. You're saying that we're going to impact negatively the work of the university, the productivity of society into the future by this kind of mechanism of giving people preferential treatment based on race, and we're gonna downgrade their degrees. We're gonna make them feel like they're second class achievers, and it's gonna and there are all these negatives, and I hear all those negatives, and you're absolutely right that they exist, and they're the more we say we're helping these people and giving them a break, the more people can say, well, they got a break, and they should not have gotten a break. But I view it a different way. I view it as they got discriminated against early in life. They got a bad break, a systematically bad break. Imagine we didn't educate. Take the other extreme, Glenn. Imagine we didn't educate an easy model. Educate black kids at all, okay? And we had a policy in place for centuries of not giving kids elementary or high school education whatsoever. And now we have the opportunity to provide some kids with, bring them into the university where they don't belong because they didn't have any education, and do our best with them so that they could educate their kids to some extent. Because we had this other policy that says that kids are black. You know, in Portugal, they had a policy of actually not teaching kids to learn, read and write for many years under the dictator that was around under Franco.
Okay, so, Larry, but we're talking about Harvard. We're talking about Harvard in the year 2018. I dare say that the majority of the African-American kids who are applying at Harvard are not disadvantaged, and that some of them will have come from very well established socioeconomic homes. Their parents have been educated. They'll have six-figure incomes and so forth. So I don't want to, you know,
I think the imprimatur of Harvard in society is a huge thing. And for us to achieve some equality through time, we need to have blacks have a fair representation of the graduates from Harvard. I think it goes beyond their, what they actually perform, and their contribution to the productivity of society. I think it has to do with, yeah, with over time, achieving.
I got it.
Much more of a colorblind society.
That's the argument of Bowen and Bach in that 1998 book, The Shape of the River, where they used the data on the longitudinal careers of the graduates of Harvard and Princeton and like places. Derek Bach, former president of Harvard, William Bowen, former president of Princeton. And they argue that when you look at the life trajectories of the people who come through, they become leaders and they have influence in the community. And that's a move toward a more integrated and equal society. And I agree with that. I agree with that as a transitional policy. I don't agree with that as a ongoing way of life. And the question becomes, again, how long and are we at the end of the period? And I'm prepared to entertain, you know, the kind of cold turkey thing, at least in certain kinds of venues, certain kinds of specialized activity. I make the distinction between undergraduate and graduate education as a case in point, but I think other such distinctions could be made. I don't know what the STEM disciplines relative to the humanistic disciplines would do. I'd be surprised if they cut it the same way in terms of the trade-off of the ethnic diversity benefit against the differential performance standards that have to be utilized in order to achieve the ethnic diversity. That difference might be much more important in STEM courses where intra-class variation in student performance was a negative. Are you following what I'm saying? I'm saying, yeah, as between a sociology class or an English literature class, American literature, on the one hand, and a class in chemical engineering or in calculus, on the other, or statistics, it might really matter. And therefore, you wouldn't want one size to fit all. You'd want to accommodate I think this is the right model there. I really do. Like I say, there's the output from the collective effort that's going on in the educational institution that depends upon the distribution of attributes of the participants. And, you gotta reckon with how, disruptive is heterogeneity in that distribution. And, the implications of racial differences in the population's traits coming into the organization would then have implications for racial differences in the allocation of people across the task within the organization, wow, which would cut against equality. And that's, I think at the end of the day, what you get is a flat organization. You get less and less gradient because what's actually happening is there's a subversion of meritocratic distinction that is kind of baked into the cake, and you make little compromises along the way. And the next thing you know, you've really just given up on the idea of making distinctions.
Yeah, I hear you. I can also argue the other way, that in the STEM areas, we need to have even more affirmative action to try and rectify an even bigger problem there.
In what areas would that be?
Well, in mathematics and science and, in economics, the training of that blacks and poor people in general have had differentially bad training in these areas in high school and primary school, and that this is where we need to make a bigger sacrifice at the university level to try and rectify the problem, and that we're engaged in a social job here that goes beyond just training top STEMers. we see this in
well, that's why I made the distinction between STEM and other fields, and I was prepared to concede that you might have a lot more latitude to do the thing, but then of course you're going to get the fact that you're going to have an underrepresentation of African Americans in the sciences. And I think what this shows is that you don't want to push the egalitarian impulse to too fine a level. You want to keep it up high enough that you can then move it around.
I think, you know,
equalize the marginal cost across all the different fields.
We face the same problem all the time. Let's move away from black versus white or Hispanic. Let's think about female male in hiring and economics departments. So we're under I wouldn't say pressure, but strong suggestion, which we share ourselves in the department, in our department,
sure,
to hire more women because women are underrepresented in economics. And the whole profession has been making, a concerted effort, and over 30 years has changed that.
Well, there's another interpretation.
It was a long go to get to any equality. And I think the women themselves would say that we are engaged in affirmative action towards women in our department. And I think the women in our department that we've hired resent that.
Sure.
Okay. And it does, and they're bearing a burden of this.
Well, I want to offer a different interpretation. I think, if you looked at the proportion of people in the top graduate programs, the PhD programs, who are women, that number has been steadily climbing. I don't know what it is at Boston University, but more than 50% of our incoming PhD students this year are women.
But that's
more than half of them. Let me make my point. My point is stocks and flows. That's my point. My point is that the flows are much more equal. And that as a result, you have to accommodate. The faculty are a stock accumulated over many past years' flows. And that's not going to move that quickly. So pressure to hire more. Okay, I don't mind that. But the underlying real dynamic that's driving the system is the flows, which will accumulate over time. And women are pretty close to equal at Brown University, and I expect at a lot of places. Well represented, 30%, 40% places, more than 50% in our incoming class of people who are getting PhDs in economics. So that's obviously going to work itself out in the fullness of time. Now, if you want to be ahead of the pack, if you want to earn honors by getting to close to the steady state in a fewer number of years than another department, then kudos to you for being pro-women. I'm happy for you. But that's not, let me just make this point, because we were talking about affirmative action. That's not the situation of blacks. We are not actually in the flows such that the underlying structures of equality between men and women, which are manifesting themselves in the economics profession, could be expected to work in a similar way for us. So if you use the same words, affirmative action, in reference to women hiring into the economics department at Boston University, you're not talking about anything like what I use the words affirmative action and talking about admitting kids to schools of engineering or elite academic programs.
So I hear you, but I still think, you know, your department and my department ranks pretty similarly, so we got a pretty similar
Yeah, quality. We think we're higher, but that's okay. I used to be, when I used to be in your department, and when I was in your department, that department was higher.
Absolutely. There's no question. And we'll be getting you back at some point, I'm sure. So I don't know that let me put it this way, that the females that are applying, that we're getting an equal number of, I haven't been that closely involved, but my guess is that we are still engaged in some affirmative action with females when it comes to accepting them into the class. That we're looking at that, at their gender, seriously as part of trying to balance the class, and that other departments around the country are doing this. Your department, I'm sure, is also. I don't think it's just that the females are showing up with the same GREs, as the males. Maybe I'm wrong in that just factually, but,
yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the case. They're showing up with the same GREs.
But yeah, and with blacks, I think, you know, it's, the other thing is we can't take really too seriously these scores, these GRE scores and SAT and grade, even GPAs from college, because a big element of becoming an excellent economist is having creativity, and we don't have a very good test for that. So it may be that part of what we need to think about is that we're coming from a just getting yourself the gumption to get up there and apply to Brown University if you're black and you came from a poor school in Roxbury and maybe a community college and you apply, that may just be evidence that you actually have the sitzfleisch, have the guts to challenge people when it comes to writing papers and thinking creatively out of the box. You know, you and I both had a student who I won't mention his name, who came from a family where the mom was a drug addict, the dad was incarcerated. He pulled himself out from his bootstraps. He was black, is black, barely, you know, did okay in college, but not at the very top. Got him into Northwestern. They engaged in some affirmative action to bring him in. He spent 6 years. He got through. It was not easy, but then he starts writing these incredibly creative papers that are beyond, I think, what you would have, far beyond what one would have expected. And he's still facing racism in his current position at the university. I won't mention the university. It's one where a noose was just put into a mailbox of a colleague who's also black.
Okay.
So I can tell stories. We can tell stories.
These are anecdotes that are, you know, I mean, I like the story. I know the kid that you're talking about, and more power to him. And to you for mentoring him and helping him along. I mean, that's all very good. And, you know, I could tell my own stories of that kind.
And you helped him too. So it was a joint project.
No, I love teaching because you get to have these relationships with these fine young people and in their lives and stuff like that. And sure, there should be African-Americans among them, including the case of, you know, like the kid that you're talking about. But, I think we should probably call it quits, Larry, because we've been talking for over an hour and we didn't get to the big con. So you have to come back to talk about – Larry has a paper out there where he says, you all think you know because the so-called Great Recession of 2008 and following. And he goes through a laundry list. I'm just going to tell people because this is something that should be read. I'm sure it's available at your website or something. Should be read. And he goes through a long laundry list of the purported causes, which I won't try to reiterate here since we're closing out. and Larry should have the last word on this. But he says, no, I'll tell you what the real cause is. See, Larry, I read your paper very closely. The real cause is there's more than one equilibrium. There's the equilibrium where everybody is okay leaving their money in the bank because they think the bank's still going to be there tomorrow. And there's the equilibrium where nobody is okay with that. And you had better be the first person to the bank to get your money out. And unless you deal with that, you're going to be set up to have the kind of situations happen again and again and again. Never mind all this stuff about funny, financial leverage, executive compensation. Never mind all these various whatever. The real deal is let's not have banks so that they can be run on. And yes, and I think that's very fundamental, Larry.
Thanks, Len. Thanks for reading it. It's called The Big Con, and it's at kotlikoff.net, and you summarized it much better than I can.
I told you I read that paper, man. I learned a lot from that paper. I'm going to get Ross Levine on after we talk, next time we talk. Ross Levine is a professor of finance at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. And used to be my colleague at Brown, and he's probably one of the most cited economists out there, as amongst other distinctions. Ross is a first rate guy, and I want to get him on because he's written about he is in a more than one of the hypotheses that you give the back of your hand to.
Okay, yeah,
about regulatory capture and self dealing with the rating agencies and stuff like that.
Yeah, maybe we could do a three-way. That would be great. And, I really enjoyed talking to you about – I feel quite honored talking about affirmative action because I think you're the deepest thinker in the country. And you've written on both sides of this issue. So people should know a lot of what you – the way you argue is to make – it's just the educational technique of taking a position and seeing how far it goes. But that you have – I think you have balanced views. And my guess is we're sitting in a committee deciding whether or not to accept somebody. We're probably going to accept the same class.
Yeah, I agree with that, Larry. Well, thanks. I mean, I should say thanks. I have written a lot about it. And when I pulled these lectures together for Toulouse, I realized, I got like a dozen papers out there on one aspect or another of this thing. And I have written on both sides of issues. That should be said. Thank you, Larry. I know I came off sounding very archly against affirmative action because I've got my deep concerns, which I tried to articulate. On the other hand, I actually wrote the foreword for the paperback edition of Bowen and Bach's book, The Shape of the River, in which I held forth at a sort of social philosophic level a disquisition on behalf of the proposition that you should do what they're trying to do, which is get some black and brown kids out of Harvard and out of Princeton and like places. So
you're playing devil's advocate, but you're doing this throughout life. I mean, it's not, you've got a history of challenging people's thinking, and that's the only way we can get to some truth is by having somebody clearly articulate a position and have some back and forth. But I do think that affirmative action is not the answer, and going overboard is also not the answer, and this suit with Harvard is really trying to go to an extreme. That's my concern.
Yeah. Yeah. And my concern, I have been writing about this my whole career. You're right. I don't know about a Nobel Prize, man. That's very generous of you. Thank you. But I'm not going to bet my life or hold my breath on that.
It's coming.
But this idea that the history has cast a long shadow and, this idea that the family and communal structures are somewhat apart from the economic and transactional structures, and yet they complement and interact with one another. So race is meaningful in that it colors, so to speak, it affects channels. Some of this informal associational behavior, these institutions like families and communities and networks of affiliation that get created, and that it's the spillover in human capital within these networks of human capital acquisition causes complementarities such that the segregation of the networks by race creates objective differences in the ability to get your hands on skill-enhancing resources, including the resource of associating with people who've already enhanced their skills. So this kind of backdrop, which leads naturally to some kind of affirmative action thing, that's the foundation out of which my kind of pro-affirmative action leanings. See, and what I'm differentiating is between the transition and the steady state. In the transition, you really do need to attend to making these positional moves, but the steady state is different. That's why how long is such a really important question.
I would say go to Hungary.
Go to Hungary and look at
look at the anti-Semitism today. We're still in the transition.
Okay. Actually, I think that we can have a whole nother conversation about this, Larry. Actually, I think that identity politics is going to die a slow and painful but inexorable death. And I think Trump is a part of that. Not that he's negating in any way. This is not trying to attribute anything positive to Trump whatsoever. But I think the forces that are at play, that's why I say people should pay attention to the shifting tectonic plates of American politics, not to the ephemera, okay? And this sort of cult of personality around Trump, I'm talking not only about his people who come to his rallies and cheer him, I'm talking about his enemies. It's still a kind of cult of personality because it's all focused on the persona of the person. And I think it misses the structural forces. So there's a backlash. I know I'm starting a whole new conversation. There's a backlash against identity politics. You can't dismiss it as racism. I mean, you can, but you're just making a mistake. You're just making a mistake. And people have not reckoned the cost of racial framings. I've been trying to say this. You talk about framing. You say the law has to mean the same thing no matter what language you put it in. So here's one. The kid got shot by a cop in an alley under ambiguous circumstances. Maybe the kid had a gun, maybe he didn't. Maybe the cop thought the kid had a gun, maybe he didn't. Happens that the cop is white and the kid is black. Newspaper story, white cop shoots black kid. Okay. Turn the page, turn the day. Cop running down the stairwell after a report of an armed man. Gets to the bottom, the armed man gets a drop on the cop. Two bullets shot into the cop's chest. Cop is white. Shooter is black. Headline, black criminal executes white police officer. Well, no, not exactly. Because headline writers don't write those headlines like that. But guess what? People think like that. So the fact that I don't see the headline doesn't mean that a lot of people who are not racist think like that. Now, here's my point. My point is you can't have it both ways. You can't have a prohibition on people thinking like that when the criminal happens to be black and the cop happens to be white, and you would rather it not be racialized. You cannot have that. It's not possible to obtain that. And at the same time, sensationalize every time that the cop happens to be white and the kid happens to be black on the presumption that race was an essential part of the event. Okay? It's not possible to have both things.
Right.
Okay, so there's something fun. Something fundamentally wrong about Black Lives Matter in the context of neutralizing racial language around violence and policing in the country. The stakes here are enormously high because the homicide rate by race varies on a scale of an order of magnitude.
Right.
Okay. People can see this. Right. You may forbid them to speak of it, but you cannot forbid them to think about it. So you better be careful what you do. You better watch out what you risk. Let me just press this point a little bit further. Police officer brought to trial. Public mob rally. Must convict.
Right.
Okay. Let it be a criminal trial, where an innocent white girl is raped on her way to school, and let the defendant be three black boys. Don't tell me this is not going to ever happen, because it will happen. It has happened.
Right.
Let there be a mob of people out in front of the courthouse talking about that like that. Okay? You don't want that. The time to speak up is now.
Okay. I agree with you on this, Glenn.
Okay, Larry, I'm so glad. We're struggling about it.
I agree with you.
Well, we're talking about race and affirmative action and steady state and stuff like that.
Yeah, we have to get to the truth in every area, and we can't, obviously if the homicide rate of blacks is very high, which it is, we have to make clear, we can't kind of put that under the rug and then just focus on white cops killing black black kids. I mean, that's a distorted picture of where all the murders are coming from in the black community. And it's letting people off the hook from taking responsibility for the problems to the extent that they are responsible for. Blacks have their, you know, obligations, and Jews have, every group has an obligation to help its own group probably fast more than anybody else. So absolutely, I agree with that. But, the idea that we're at a steady state, that the history of racism, in our country it's now at the end, and that, things have, we're at a point where we can kind of ignore race in educational, admissions at the university level. We may differ, or we may not. Again, you know, you and I sit in a particular situation, an admissions committee. We may choose the same class in the end, is my guess, because, I feel a lot of you feel a lot. We care about people. We got a balance. It's a balance. It's a balancing act. That's what the Supreme Court said. There are smart people on that court that decided that race was an important aspect of diversifying a class, and that maybe they're talking about the value of an integrated college education. So, I do think, you know, when it comes down to this Harvard case, that could do real damage if it says, look, you can't use these set of words, and then increasingly we can't use any set of words to use race as a criteria for admissions, and then it has to become, well, maybe we can't use SAT scores because that's also not objective. It's not fair to some groups. This can move into different directions.
Well, you bring up the Harvard case again. So here's what I think is going on. So the plaintiff's expert runs some regressions where he tries to associate the likelihood of getting admitted with various characteristics of the applicant, including the racial group that they belong to. And he finds that, in effect, on the average, the Asians have a lower chance of getting in, holding constant their other characteristics than do other groups, and blacks have a higher chance of getting in, holding constant their other characteristics. Although he's not just pitting the Asians against the blacks, but that's part of what he finds. What's on the right-hand side of that regression? That is to say, what's the list of factors that he's prepared to control for when trying to explain whether or not a student gets admitted? To the extent that those are only academic factors, like your test score, your grades, the number of AP classes that you took, and so forth and so on, letters of recommendation. Now, maybe you throw in extracurricular activities and whatnot. To the extent that you've got something like that, the Asian coefficient comes in large negative in that regression, which is to say being Asian makes you much less likely to get admitted, controlling for those characteristics. However, if you expand the set of explanatory factors to include personality assessments, then the disparity between Asians and others goes down, because on average, Asians do less well on the personality assessment factors. Now, here's the critical question. Has Harvard adopted the emphasis on personality factors as a subterfuge for wanting to have fewer Asians come in? Because you can't really resolve this argument unless you decide that it's legitimate to put the non-academic factors on the right-hand side of that regression. And the decision to include those factors might itself have been motivated by a desire to achieve a particular racial outcome. Now, here's one way that you can test that. If those factors are powerful within groups in determining who gets in, which is to say, if there exists a black kid with low personality ratings but a high test score who doesn't get admitted, right, and there exists an Asian kid with low test scores but high personality ratings, now you got thousands, tens of thousands of applicants. So there are going to be some people in every one of those boxes.
Right.
You can test this. I haven't. But I'll bet a dime. You put down the dime, I'll put down a $10 bill. You're not going to find any black kids with high academic performances being rejected, regardless of what their personality is. Okay. And I'll bet you, you find very few Asian kids with low test scores being admitted, regardless of what their personality is. So that militates, if that hypothetical is correct, in favor of the hypothesis that the adoption of the personality ratings is to some degree a strategy that's in the service of getting more people who are not Asian into the university.
I started out saying that.
Let me just make this point. I'm sorry to go on so long, but this is an important point. People talk about voter suppression. They say that Republican legislatures are adopting rules and tactics around when the voting is going to take place and so forth and so on. That's designed to disenfranchise blacks. They are. It's the same argument. There's a lot of discretion in the hour of the polling place, the length of time before ballot that you can cast an early ballot, the rules about who is going to be able to be to demonstrate their eligibility to cast a ballot, and so forth and so forth. A lot of discretion. You can calculate the differential incidence on different racial groups of tweaking the system in one way or another, and that's exactly what the Republicans are doing. That's exactly what Harvard is doing.
Yeah. And
you don't like one, you don't like the other.
Well,
seriously, it's my argument.
I guess it's a little different.
Like either one of them. Y'all, you know, I got problems with both of them. Asians have worse personalities. Think about that for a minute. Man. Suppose it was blacks. Suppose a different world. Suppose it was Jews. Perhaps that doesn't suppose a counterfactual that's not imaginable, but by which they had found some personality measures too pushy. That would be wrong, right? You can see clearly that would be wrong. So,
well, I mean, if only Jews were, you know, I do think this was a phony mechanism, probably a phony mechanism just to achieve some racial preference for blacks. And I think that's fine. I think because if you had otherwise gone and said, we're going to just give blacks a higher score because they're black, period, that would have been perfectly legal. And this other way of doing it is perfectly legal because that way is perfectly legal. And they're just different languages. So
they're going to say something about a holistic approach. They're going to say every application is read in the context of the life of the person who applies, and their race is a part of that calculation. And they're going to say we're looking for the whole person in some kind of context. And that's going to be very hard to refute. I mean, if you give them that much latitude, you pretty much guarantee that they'll be able to implement whatever preferences that they have. I mean, that's probably the way that the court should look at it. They should say what rules are most robust against being manipulated by a variety of different possible preferences that the actor might have, because we can't know what their preferences are. So what should the rules of the game be, given that we know people are going to try to game the rules? The holism, the idea of holistic, you know, it's intrinsically subjective. It's almost by definition subjective. It strenuously resists quantification, which means clarification. So therefore, it means no accountability. You've got an opaque accounting system. You don't have any accountability.
Right. Okay. So
I think measuring the holistic personality is a very opaque accounting system.
You know, if it were crystal clear what would be a fair way or the proper way to include race in admissions, which Supreme Court said is legal, they would have come out, they would have given some suggestions in their decision. But they took, I think, the path of saying it's up to you, and now we have these court cases because every mechanism that's being tried to achieve that is being contested. So I would say, look, you have to look at each particular issue. Is redistricting to try and bias you know, keep disenfranchise people from voting, is that a proper thing that you want to allow in society? And I'd say no. Is race-based admission something you want to incorporate in higher education? I would say yes. So it might be that that the mechanisms are somehow you know, similar that are being used, and somehow this mechanism is okay here but not okay there. It doesn't really matter. That's, again, language. What we're looking at is the outcome. And are we achieving fair outcomes for society here?
We're looking at the rule. Well, that, what I'm looking at is the rule. I'm looking at the rule of whether you want to allow surreptitious or indirect racial influence via the manipulation of non-racial, variables.
I'm saying let's not make it so surreptitiousness does not really matter. I think it's pretty obvious that, at least based on the facts so far, that Harvard probably did downgrade the personalities of the Asians in order to achieve.
Well, then that's the ball game. They discriminated. That violates the Civil Rights Act of 1960.
It's not the ball game, because if they use, if they produce the same mathematical outcome, if they upranked everybody's personality except the Asians, they would have had.
Come on, Larry, that's just where zero is. That can't matter. It's the difference between them that matters.
In the end, you have to, race is just a particular criteria, right? It's, you're either black or you're not. Right? Okay. And so it's not an individualistic criteria. So you're going to have to take that group and score them up or score everybody else down. It's that simple. So it's going to have to end up being, kind of a mechanism no matter what.
I think this is the mess that we've gotten ourselves into. I think the ideals are really not consistent with one another. The idea of non-racialism, implicit in the Civil Rights Act, and the idea of affirmative action, which puts race in a central position. I think that that's why I say it can only be a transitional and it can't be an ongoing thing. And I think the clock has basically run out. Sandra Day O'Connor said, I think it was 2003, she said, we would not be in this business 25 years from now, and that kind of compromise opinion, I think it was 6-3, I'm not sure, Grutter versus Bollinger. This was University of Michigan.
Yeah.
But
she's optimistic. She should come.
No, nah, man, we should have another conversation about it. We cannot be in the permanent business of helping black people. The country can't be in the permanent business. Slavery ended a long time ago. I know. This is my business. I write about intergenerational effects. I know. I understand. Still, cannot be in the permanent business. Got to get out of that business.
Well,
help people. Help people. I don't mean to say don't help anybody. Help people.
I hear you. And, so are just being an instant decision about folks based on their appearance and how they dress and all kinds of things that, and you've written about this more eloquently and deeply than anybody else about how those impressions, because we don't have full information about people, lead to sorting and lead to self-sorting. So the idea that we're not going to end up with a society where everybody's the same color. So we may have this as a permanent problem. I don't see how you can think otherwise, to tell you the truth.
Oh, I actually have some kind of hopeful vision that, through intermarriage and stuff like that, because I'd only centralize race. I think it's, an ethnic, sort of cultural, historical inheritance. I don't mean to minimize it. I descend, at least in part, from Africans who were enslaved in the United States. But it doesn't have to be, and I only speak about me personally, it does not have to be the end-all and be-all of my own life, but I also want to speak about my children, grandchildren, and I want to speak more generally. I think it should be open-ended. I think time will tell. The future will. Well, are African-Americans, I don't know, like the Roma? or some, you know, very, you know, you go hundreds and hundreds of years and they're kind of underdogs in society across all of Europe, Central, East, and Southeastern Europe? Yeah.
I think that should be our working hypothesis.
Are they like the Untouchables, the ballots in the caste-ridden Indian society of subordinate whatever? I mean, come on, these analogies strain credulity. I don't think so.
You're making my case, Glenn.
Pardon? I'm making your case?
Yeah. Like, look at the Untouchable, the fact that...
No, I'm saying society, we're different.
What?
I'm saying whereas untouchability in Indian Hindu culture is a millennia-old practice which has given only some ground. And whereas the Roma in Europe, in Southeastern Europe, are an ethnic group of semi-nomadic. I don't know. I don't know a whole lot about them. But I do know that it's an enduring stigma. And I don't think African-Americans are anything like either of these populations. And in fact, it's the differences that make me hopeful. I think intermarriage is a good thing. I will now go on the record. This is a way off of our subject matter or perhaps even our expertise, but I'll say that the idea that you should try to preserve some kind of ideal blackness against the assimilative pressures that have affected every other ethnic group in the U.S., the Italian, the Jews, the Irish, the Eastern Europeans, the Slavic, and whatnot. And they've all intermarried at very high rates. The Asians are intermarrying at very high rates. You can either, like, in a way, make it be a self-fulfilling prophecy. We have a racial stigma and black people and white people won't marry each other. I was just in France. There were a lot of interracial couples that I saw. Or you can have some kind of more expansive view. So all of this protection of blackness, this kind of cultural, what do they call it, cultural appropriation, you know, they're trying to draw a fence around blackness. I think it's a mistake. That's the future. The future is not with intrinsic protest against the American nation state by African Americans defining ourselves politically in opposition to the state. The future is embracing our Americanness. I don't mean necessarily to get a Make America Great Again hat and put it on your head, but I do mean to stop now with the reflexive knee-jerk anti-Americanism. Have you read the Platform for Black Lives Matter, their manifesto? I don't know that you will have done, but what you will see there is Noam Chomsky-esque left-wing rhetoric about the American nation state. It's a mistake. It's a fundamental error. So I think the future for Black Americans is a future as Americans. We have a tremendous advantage that the Dalits of the Roma don't have. We're American citizens. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the ironies just confound me. Here it is that the pro-migrant people say that the country's a membership in the country should be open to people seeking sanctuary. And I'm not against that because it's a very valuable resource.
Right.
Now, African Americans have it by birthright and centuries long entitlement. Why would you throw it away by making, for example, a flag related ceremony at a sporting event the site to protest racial policing? Why would you do that? It's gratuitously a deep mistake. So says Glenn Lowry.
So sounds. I think we're going to have to argue on that one a little bit.
Yeah,
down the road.
We've run on. I agree.
But I actually support that act of protest. I think it's not that we shouldn't be having other acts of protest, which focus on many of the things that you raised today that haven't been said and aren't being said enough. And I think you're providing a very important, counter view to traditional, to the Noam Chomsky perspective, but they're both, I think they're both valid. I think they both need to be heard very loudly and clearly so that we can get to the right middle ground. It's not one or the other. There is racism. There are blacks being shot by white policemen at a disproportionate rate, and we have to worry about that.
I think it's questionable about how disproportionate it is, Larry. That's why Roland Fryer's study based on the Houston data and his looking at the stop and frisk data in New York City.
Well, you know what, Glenn, if it's not factually supported, that needs to be said loud and clear, and I'll be the first or I'll be the second after you to be. So you tell me the numbers and I'll be talking about them.
Okay, more later. Let's ring off for now. So say goodbye. Thanks, Larry, for coming on the Glenn Show. It's a really interesting, wide-ranging, and long conversation. I'm going to stop recording. Thank you.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.